Now, time for us to catch up on stories that have been making headlines around the world on World Report with Sharon Lynch.
Good morning. On today's programme, Delhi hospital fined over sperm mix-up, and Canada moves to seize a Russian cargo jet for Ukraine. First to Japan, where the Japanese government is moving ahead with its controversial plan to discharge radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear power station into the Pacific Ocean. Some 1.33 million cubic metres of groundwater, rainwater and water used for cooling has accumulated at the stricken site, which is being decommissioned after several reactors went into meltdown following the 2011 tsunami, which badly damaged the plant. From Japan, Brian Gaynor reports.
On the flight from Sapporo to Tokyo, you fly over Tohoku, the region in northeastern Japan devastated by the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. Even now, more than a decade later, you can still see the scars on the landscape, bare brown patches of coastal land scoured of human habitation. As the plane continues further south, you see another after effect of the disaster. Hundreds and hundreds of giant storage tanks, like steel pimples on the landscape, clustered around a messy knot of cranes and gantries. This is the infamous Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. And stored inside all those tanks is over 1.3 million tons of the most radioactive water on the planet. This accumulated water is a result of the cooling measures needed to keep the melted reactors at Fukushima from overheating. Every day, 100 tons of water is flushed through the corroded reactors and then pumped into the giant blue and white storage tanks. The problem is that very soon, all these storage tanks will be full, and there isn't any room to build more of them. In response, the Japanese government plans to discharge the stored water into the Pacific Ocean. For both scientific consensus and political cover, the Japanese government requested the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to undertake a two-year feasibility study of the plan. Earlier this week, Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the agency, visited Tokyo and stated that the discharged water would have a negligible radiological impact on people and the environment. He described the disposable strategy as safe and in line with global standards. However, given that 1.3 million tons of irradiated water from a nuclear disaster has never been discharged into the ocean before, it's questionable as to how standard these global standards actually are. The chief concern is a hydrogen isotope called radioactive tritium. Unlike other heavier isotopes, such as cesium and plutonium, there is no technology currently capable of removing tritium from the wastewater. The plan is to wash, rinse, and repeat to try and dilute the tritium. This water will then be gradually released into the ocean over a period of decades. According to both the Japanese government and the IAEA, this should effectively render the tritium harmless. But this is essentially a guess, rather than a factual certainty. A number of scientists have highlighted the possibility of tritium accumulating in sea life as it passes through the marine food chain. The tritium could be bioaccumulated in larger marine organisms such as fish and squid, which could then be caught and eaten by humans. In an effort to allay such fears, a spokesperson for the Japanese Ministry of Environment stated that the treated water will be safe enough to drink. "Well, then go ahead and drink it," was the pointed rejoinder from the Pacific Islands Forum, a grouping of island nations. The forum called the plan another major nuclear contamination disaster. They are not alone in criticizing the plan. China has called on Japan not to discharge the water into the Pacific and to consider other methods of disposing the stored water. In Korea, there have been large public demonstrations in front of the Japanese embassy. Within Japan itself, public reaction has been more ambiguous. A recent nationwide survey found that 45% of respondents were opposed to the plan, while 40% were in favour. But the uncomfortable fact remains that Japan intends to discharge radioactive water from a catastrophic nuclear disaster into the Pacific Ocean. In our short nuclear age, Japan is yet again bearing testimony to the seemingly unbounded hubris of man. For World Report, this is Brian Gaynor in Hokkaido in northern Japan.
Next to India, where a mix-up in a fertility clinic in New Delhi resulted in a woman getting pregnant with a stranger's sperm instead of her husband's. The aggrieved couple had to fight for justice for 14 years before a consumer court ordered a hefty compensation. From India, Sajida Momin has more.
India's top consumer court has awarded 15 million rupees or 168,000 euros as damages to twin girls who were conceived after their mother was given the wrong man's sperm during an assisted reproductive procedure performed on the couple in a leading hospital in New Delhi. The mix-up came to light after the DNA tests were done, as the girls bore no resemblance to the woman's husband. The National Consumer Disputes Redressal Commission imposed a hefty penalty on the hospital management, doctors and the embryologists for their criminal negligence, which destroyed the couple's genealogy. The Indian IVF industry is a potential 10 billion euro market, but not properly regulated. The case, which is now making headlines, dates back to 2008, when Priyanka Tandon and her husband, Dinesh Tandon, approached Bhatia Global Hospital and Endosurgery Institute in New Delhi after Priyanka was unable to conceive. In October 2008, Priyanka's eggs were fertilized with what the hospital claimed was her husband Dinesh's sperm. The hospital's doctors confirmed her pregnancy within a month, and Priyanka delivered twin girls in June 2009. The couple was naturally very happy, but as time passed, they noticed that the twins bore no resemblance to them. Suspecting the mix-up, they got their baby's blood tested. One of the twins turned out to be AB positive, whereas Priyanka is B positive, and her husband Dinesh is O negative. The baby's blood group was not a combination of both parents, as it should have been. It meant that while Priyanka was the biological mother, Dinesh was not the biological father. Their worst fears were reconfirmed by a paternity test via DNA profiling at the top-rated Center for Cellular and Molecular Biology in Hyderabad. The DNA tests established once and for all that the twin girls were related only to Priyanka and not to Dinesh. The results hit the Tandons like a sledgehammer, and they lost no time in suing the hospital and the doctors who treated them for record damages. They demanded a hefty compensation for the gross negligence and deficiency in service, which resulted in emotional stress, family dishonour, and exposed the girls to genetically inherited diseases. But the case dragged on in the consumer court, as cases invariably do in any Indian court, thanks to the sheer volume of litigation, shortage of judges, and poor court infrastructure. Bhatia Hospital tried to wash its hands of the botched procedure by claiming that the doctors responsible for it were not its employees and merely used its facilities for a fee. And the three doctors charged by the Tandons tried to pass the buck, blaming one another for the fiasco. They also fell back on medical and IVF jargon to confuse the court and cover their tracks. But all efforts by the hospital management and the doctors to evade liability failed. The consumer court's judgment came after more than a decade, but it did not spare anyone. The scathing verdict held all the accused persons as collectively responsible for what the court aptly called a disaster. Judge S. M. Kantikar, who presided over the bench, did not mince his words. His order said that due to negligence during the IVF procedure, the genetic link between the parents and children had been severed. He added that the destruction of the genetic link between two generations has social and ethical implications for family and heredity. The judge even remarked that the Tundons have been saddled with giving explanations to their children later in life. The court observed that the mix-up happened either during the collection of sperm or during storage for 4 hours, resulting in Priyanka's extracted eggs being fertilized with a stranger's semen. The court said failure to cough up the compensation within 6 weeks would attract a penalty of 8% interest per annum. Besides penalizing the guilty hospital and doctors who wreaked havoc in the life of the Tundons, the verdict has also thrown a spotlight on India's booming but shady IVF business. The judgment said that the foundations of the fertility industry are laid on unfair trade practices and misleading advertisements to allure childless couples. It slammed gynecologists without in-depth knowledge of assisted reproductive technology opening clinics simply because there is money in it. And it emphasized that greed often leads to incorrect treatment. Judge Kantikar observed that childless couples are emotionally and financially stressed, but fertility clinics do not hesitate to take full advantage of their condition. Importantly, a copy of the order has been sent to the National Medical Council and the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare to frame more stringent rules to rein in the IVF industry. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
And finally, a drama has been playing out over a Russian-owned cargo plane that's been sitting on the tarmac at Toronto's Pearson International Airport for more than a year. The plane was grounded after Canada closed its airspace to Russian aircraft following the invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Dan Karpinchuk reports from Toronto.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made a surprise visit to Ukraine in early June, traveling to Kyiv to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In a 25-minute speech to the Ukrainian parliament, he accused Moscow of a new colonial approach in Ukraine, adding that Ukraine is fighting for us all. He also outlined another $500 million in military aid to Kyiv and pledged more weapons and fighter pilot training. And he said Canada will support Ukraine's bid for membership in NATO. Trudeau said Canada will continue to stand with Ukraine with whatever it takes, as long as it takes. He also offered more money for those coping with the humanitarian crisis in the southern part of the country. And he outlined another round of sanctions against 24 individuals and 17 entities for allegedly stealing cultural artifacts and damaging heritage sites in Ukraine. And he said his government has seized a huge Russian-registered Antonov 124 cargo plane that's been grounded at the Toronto International Airport since February of 2022. Within days, the seizure of the Russian cargo plane was confirmed in Ottawa by Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly. The Antonov 24 is believed to be owned by a subsidiary of Volga-Dnieper Airlines, which Canada recently imposed sanctions against. The seizure was made possible by a new Canadian law, the Special Economic Measures Act, put forward in 2022 and is in direct response to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It allows federal authorities to seize and manage assets or forfeit, dispose and redistribute those assets belonging to sanctioned individuals and entities. Taking the cargo plane was in direct response to Russia's invasion, and it's designed to put even more economic pressure on Moscow to stop what Ottawa calls an illegal war against Ukraine, and so it can't be used to support Russia's war effort. It was the first physical asset seized under the Canadian law. Trudeau's government says the plan is to give the plane to Ukraine to help compensate victims of human rights abuses or to help rebuild the country. In a Facebook post, Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal says his government is preparing to confiscate the cargo plane and other Russian assets in Canada and transfer them to the benefit of his country. The Antonov 124 is one of the largest aircraft in the world, and there are concerns it could be used by Russia to deliver military supplies for its war against Ukraine. Russia was quick to respond, summoning Canada's top diplomat in Moscow to the foreign ministry to protest over the seizure of the cargo plane. He was told that Ottawa's move could result in the most serious repercussions. 2 days earlier, Moscow had warned that relations with Canada were on the verge of being severed. The foreign ministry also said the move amounts to an attempt at undisguised robbery and was disgraceful. Russia says it reserves the right to retaliate in line with the reciprocity principle. Some Canadian sanctions experts had warned that Ottawa should brace for such retaliation if it does forfeit the plane. Canada's actions are also being closely watched by its allies and other Western nations. It's become the first G7 country to enact a law to seize assets and divert funds to the victims of a sanctioned regime. So how this plays out will be significant, and Russia would be deeply concerned if other countries followed Canada's lead. There are also concerns in Canada that Canadian companies and individuals in Russia could be put at risk. Meanwhile, Ottawa has yet to make good on a pledge 6 months ago to seize the funds held in Canada by Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich. No court application has yet been made. As for the cargo plane, Trudeau says his government will proceed as quickly as possible. When the process does begin, and there's no sign yet of when that will happen, the owners of the plane can launch a court challenge to the seizure. Meanwhile, the plane remains grounded at the Toronto airport, and the owner of the plane is being billed 74 cents a minute to park there. That's more than $1,000 a day. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
That's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Sharon Lynch, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.